superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Enchantment with Lake Superior's South Shore takes many forms.
It's a love letter to the South Shore that's part travelogue, part memoir, and part natural history.
I tell of the pleasures of our summers on the beach and the pain of loss as climate change accelerates the natural process of erosion.
Sue Leaf shares her story of impermanence. Plus, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? The answer is practice, and Eddie Ojard has been doing it most of his 15 years. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The south shore of Lake Superior varies from its red sandstone cliffs on the ever-changing Big Lake to abandoned mining communities. Humans have lived with that environment for millennia, from the Anishinaabe, who consider it as alive as themselves, to industrial concerns looking for a quick, if dirty, profit. It also attracts countless tourists who just want to enjoy its beauty. Author Sue Leaf knows it well, as much as anyone from the region, although she wasn't born there. Originally from the Twin Cities area, she first sojourned to the North Shore and then explored the South on a bicycle trip with her later husband that didn't match their ambition, but gave them a taste of the area, enough so to eventually move there. They've been yo-yoing back and forth since then. Now she's captured it in a book, Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. And she joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Sue Leaf.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
And so where is here? Where are we talking to you from?
I am on the lake, 4 miles west of Port Wayne, Wisconsin, in our new cabin.
And is there anybody within the stone's throw or miles?
Any other person other than my husband?
Right.
well, we just got up here yesterday, the first time in a month, and we have not seen any of our neighbors.
Okay, but you do have some furry friends, I understand.
Yes. This morning when I was out for my walk, I saw that we had animal tracks on our driveway, and I thought it was either a coyote or a bobcat or a fisher. I think it is a bobcat.
Well, something that's true of many places with very distinct characteristics like the South Shore is if you weren't born there, you'll forever be considered an outsider. So have you experienced that sentiment?
No.
No?
Not at all.
You're the first person I've asked that to who says no. Yes.
No. Well, when we lived in Ashland, people knew that we were not from the area. But my husband was a physician up there, and we're allowed to be a little bit odd because, you know, because most doctors do come in to a smaller community. Many of them are homegrown. And so we were in that odd class and accepted for that reason. The people of Port Wing have been very welcoming. And I'm thinking particularly of the librarian and the historian and the owner of the small convenience store whose family are fishermen out of Port Wing. And so I guess I just don't view our place in the grand scheme of things as outsiders.
So let's get into the people. You write about quirky places and characters. Can you tell us, give us a hint of a character or two?
Quirky people? I don't know. It's funny you should mention the word quirky, because this morning, as we were getting ready to get up, I said to my husband, I said, in my book, I talk about cabins having quirky features. And do you think this new cabin has any quirky features? You know, and this is not something an architect normally builds into the cabin. And then I looked over and we have the stained glass or the leaded glass windows from my childhood cabin, which began life, we think, as windows in a bar outside of Little Falls, Minnesota. And they're right there in our west wall. And I thought, well, okay, that's a little quirky.
So that's a bit of quirkiness that you brought to it. It wasn't the...
Yes, okay. I guess.
What about places that have their own, particular idiosyncrasies or, you know, places that just stand out?
You know, the natural attractions, at least in our area, are small and beautiful and not continuously visited, so they remain untouched. I'm thinking of, we just did a a hike outside of Cornucopia from Lost Creek Falls. It goes through a deciduous woods. We hiked it in November when the leaves were down. And it goes to a small waterfall that comes off the sandstone. And it was just gorgeous, this beautiful little waterfall. And again, nothing around it. There was some signage to get to it. But, you know, it's not developed. There's no picnic tables. It is just there. Mm-hmm. And we have one about a mile away from our cabin as well, which I haven't been to for quite a while now. Orienta Falls comes off that same sandstone level. So it's about the same height. A very beautiful little falls.
Well, we're speaking with Sue Leaf. She's just written Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. It's just been published by the University of Minnesota Press. She'll be reading from it at Zenith Bookstore in Duluth on January 23rd at 7 p.m. So how about a segment from the book?
Okay, I'm going to read from the introduction. It's titled Loving and Losing the South Shore. Down at the beach, the view across the lake this morning is shrouded by mist that hangs low on the water. Some days, the Minnesota shoreline, 22 miles away, is visible, and other days, it is not. When it is clear, I can see the town of Two Harbors with its water tower and some big building, maybe an arena. At night, the Two Harbors light with its distinctive flash pattern punctuates the darkness. At other times, like today, fog hangs heavy, sometimes near in, sometimes far away, obscuring the horizon. Whatever thoughts of eternity that a long view might offer are veiled and vague. I just never know what Lake Superior will offer me. For 34 years, our family has owned a rustic cabin on Superior's South Shore outside of Port Wing, Wisconsin. We have spent our summers walking the sand beach, skipping stones, swimming to sandbars, and lounging at water's edge in low-slung chairs, unread books on laps, contemplating the horizon and the distant shore. 2 weekends ago, during a cabin stay, my husband Tom and I went down to the water to walk our beach. The day before, there had been cobbles there, but now a 20-foot-wide sand beach had appeared overnight. A strong northwest wind had pushed the sand towards us. A sandy beach meant that finding agates was less likely, but we might come upon animal tracks, and we did. Possibly a bobcat, perhaps a coyote. It was the cliffs, though, that arrested me. They were wet and oozing from the night's storm. They looked raw and wounded in a way that they had not when we were young parents, with small children playing in the sand beneath them. I wondered how this erosion would finally resolve, and if we would be around to see the endpoint. Enchantment with Lake Superior's South Shore takes many forms. In this book, I recount how my husband and I were introduced to the South Shore as young people and how we came to own a cabin here. I tell of the pleasures of our summers on the beach and the pain of loss as climate change accelerates the natural process of erosion, taking beloved trees and beaches as it intensifies. I speak to my contemporaries who are likewise caught in the Big Lake's thrall. I relate stories of people who swim, fish, and work on Superior. I go back in history and ponder what drew people in initially and what fruits their labors bore. I ponder how the beauty of the shore was diminished and what people did to repair the damage. Above all, I write of the transitory nature of human endeavor that is reflected in the changing aspect of the South Shore. There is no refuge here, no illusion of permanence. We are just passing through. We are at the mercy of the one true lake.
That was Sue Leaf reading from her book, Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. It's just been published by the University of Minnesota Press, and she'll be reading from it at Zenith Bookstore in Duluth on January 23rd at 7 p.m. You start out in your excerpt there in the introduction talking about Two Harbors, which you can see from the Port Wing area and right. Obviously mm-hmm. vice versa, too. What's the difference to you between the North and South Shore? And we've had climatologists and geologists on the show who have actually told us some very interesting differences, but you've experienced them. So, you know, what stands out to you?
Well, we usually spend a couple days at least on the North Shore Almost never in the summer because it's just too darn busy. We have for 40 some years gotten a room at Cascade Lodge and then skied the trails, the cross-country ski trails around Cascade. And it's the North Shore is less busy in the winter than it is in the summer. But and Cascade, when my husband was a teenager, he would lie down in front of the lodge on Highway 61 to watch the northern skies, the starry skies on the road. And you wouldn't do that now. But when I went out for a walk this morning on the South Shore, one car passed me in the 20 minutes I was out. So it's just not quite as busy as the North Shore is. And again, when I think of the North Shore, I think of hiking in the state parks, and I think of cross-country skiing, and all of this is done on the hillside up off the water. When I think of the South Shore, I think of people swimming, people boating. I think of people hiring guides to go out in, you know, fishing on Lake Superior. They interact with the water. You go to Ashland, Wisconsin, and there are several swim beaches, you know, within walking distance of people in town. So there just seems to be more, they're more immersed in the lake. Mm-hmm. Rather than looking at it.
And you're supporting, from an experiential point of view, what the climatologists are telling us, which is that the temperature of that water when you jump in and loot and you get out right away versus Port Wing can be quite a difference.
Right. And I will say that it has definitely changed since we first bought into the cabin. When in the 1980s, late 80s and early 90s when we were here, it was really cold to stay in more than 10 minutes, even in August. And that's not the case now.
On the South Shore.
On the South Shore. The water has warmed up quite a bit.
Do you have another segment you would like to share with us?
Sure. I would read from my essay, Plumbing the Depths, which talks about a breed of angler called a bobber. And it's not the bobber that you would put on your line when you're fishing for panfish. Okay, so I'm reading from Plumbing the Depths. Far out on the horizon, you see them, small dark figures stark against the immensity of ice and sky, dwarfed by the yawn of a very big lake, a true depiction, I think, of the relationship of humans to Lake Superior. The figures are bobbers, fishermen who venture far out from shore to where the lake runs deep. These are not the little red and white balls that attach to fishing lines. These are human beings who travel some distance over Superior's ice to reach waters that are 100 to 200 feet deep. They are fishing for lake trout, a prized cold water fish that fights when hooked, and one with a succulent, buttery taste. Fish in deep waters grow large, and sport anglers respect large fish. Great size signifies great age, and big ones, in truth, may not be eaten if caught, but photographed and returned to the depths to live and breed another day. I was in my 30s when I first saw bobbers out on the ice. I thought that they were nuts, these men out for foolish glory and the need to prove their masculinity by landing a really big fish. I don't think that anymore. As I have grown older, I have seen how presenting oneself to extreme physical challenge can reveal something about oneself, how it can define a person's place in the great scheme of things. The sheer distance needed to reach a place where one can cut a hole and drop a line 100 feet down once limited the scope of bobbing. Old timers recall stories of early bobbers using dog sleds to venture miles from shore. One or two dogs, sometimes a team, pulling a sled with gear and hauling a nice catch of fish on the return trip. Early bobbers often used a boat outfitted with runners, like repurposed old skis, to haul the gear, pushing the boat ahead of them. These handmade wooden boats, now a thing of the past, had a dual purpose. They could float and could be rowed in case things turned ugly on unstable ice. Technology soon stepped in, and bobbers, creative problem solvers, rose to the challenge of adjusting it. The Ford Model 8 proved very popular. They were reliable starters and built to last. Some anglers modified them to haul gear. Some added chains to the back wheels for traction. Some tied long poles to front and back bumpers. If the car broke through the ice, the poles would hold it up. Still, there was no modifying human risk. A lot of Model A's went through the ice and ended up on the bottom. Model T's, which preceded the Model A and were smaller, were also popular. In one story, several Model T's carried anglers out to the east side of Madeline Island. The cars were lined up offshore from the island, anglers busy at their holes when the ice broke off. Both the cars and their anglers went for a ride. The story could have ended tragically, but it didn't. The ice floe wedged against the shore miles away at Saxon Harbor, whereupon the fishermen started up their reliable Model T's and drove home.
Well, the next time I'm looking at the shallow waters of the South Shore, I'm going to see if we see any Model T's or Model A's down there. I was asking about quirky places and people, but I forgot about quirky innovations, and you just captured one right there. We're speaking with Sue Leaf. She's reading from her book, Impermanence, Life and Loss on the Superior South Shore. It's just been published by the University of Minnesota Press. She'll be reading from it at Zenith Bookstore in Duluth on January 23rd at 7 p.m. Is this mostly a collection of vignettes like the one you just shared, without giving it away? Or is there an arc of a narrative that ends up with a conclusion?
Well, it's a funny question that you should ask, because when I first thought about the book, I did envision it as a collection of vignettes. I thought, I know all these stories about the South Shore, and I haven't read anything about them, you know, and people that have been writing about the North Shore. And so I thought I will just write them down. But then an arc emerged as I was writing, but it took me a while to see what the connection was. And it was, in fact, a committee from the University of Minnesota Press who identified the unifying theme as one of impermanence. And so we were having trouble getting a title for the book, and they landed on that. And when they told me, I thought, very interesting. And I went back and read it, the book again, and thought, yeah, okay, here it is. And every single essay, I'm talking about a change that we never light on, eternity.
You mentioned being in your 30s, early in your exploration or experience in the area. We're a little bit older than that now, we won't say. Are you looking at retirement? And would it be at the South Shore, on the South Shore?
Well, my husband is retired. Writers generally don't retire. And so I'm still writing. And we will not spend every day of the year here. But because of the new cabin, we could spend potentially all our days here. And, you know, frankly, I'd be really happy, even not like today on our visit up here. It's just so wonderful to be here and see what it looks like in the snow, to see what birds are still around, and to watch the lake in all its glory.
And don't forget the bobcat who's been checking on you.
Right. It's not a surprise to see a bobcat, but it is, well, it feels really wonderful to think that there's a wild cat out there walking around.
Who is intent on autographing your book.
With
yes, a paw
I
print.
Guess.
Yes. Well, we've been speaking with Sue Leaf. She's just published Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. Thank you for joining us, Sue.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Coming up, Eddie Ojard shares his Carnegie Hall debut and his fifth album. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. When Eddie Ojard first joined us on the show in 2021, the Two Harbors pianist and composer had just completed his third album just around his 13th birthday. He's now 15 and on to at least album number 5, he can correct me on that, and regularly performs throughout the region as well as nationally now, and yes, at Carnegie Hall. But he hasn't forgotten us here at home, and he joins me now. Welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio, Eddie.
Hi, yeah, thank you for having me.
So I have the numbers right? Was it 3 back then and 5 now, or?
Yeah, Yeah, I'm currently working on my fifth album right now.
Well, we all know the old saw about the person asking directions in New York. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? And they get the answer, practice, practice. So you've been practicing since you were four, but this was a competition. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it was just a competition that my teachers thought I should do. I mean, the opportunity to perform at Carnegie Hall was obviously a very interesting venue for me to do. And so I, you know, worked up a piece and turned it in. And yeah, thankfully I was accepted to perform. And yeah, it was a great experience and opportunity for me.
Mm-hmm. You had just switched music teachers when we last had you on. And because your previous one was leaving town. Who are you studying with now?
I'm studying with a teacher from UWS, Dr. Landa. Hector Landa. And yeah, he's been very good teacher so far.
Well, that practice is clearly paying off. Let's hear your Carnegie Hall performance, L'Aïeul Jouisse by Claude Debussy. You want to tell us a little bit about the piece?
Yeah, the piece is very, it's during the Impressionistic time. So L'Aïeul Jouisse translates to the Island of Joy. And it's about this voyage that a bunch of people took, and they're trying to travel to this island where supposedly everything will be perfect there. It's like the Island of Joy. But there is two interpretations of this story. One interpretation is that when they get to the island, it's actually the opposite of what they thought. So it was everyone is kind of angry there and no one was ever happy. The other interpretation was that they went to the island and everything was perfect and they just lived there and everything was peaceful. So you can hear that throughout the piece. In the beginning, it's very mysterious, like as if they're traveling to get to island. And, you know, you can hear some waves or fish popping out of the, you know, sea. And then in the end, it's very climactic and it's kind of celebrating that, you know, they got to the island.
All right. Well, let's hear L'Aïeul Jouisse by Claude Debussy, performed by Eddie Ojard.
Thank you.
was Lyle Joyce by Claude Debussy, performed by Eddie Ojard of Two Harbors, performed at Carnegie Hall. So you told us the story behind the piece, but who selected it? Was it your idea or was it part of the competition? And tell us about the competition. What was it?
Yeah, so my teacher was the one who selected the piece. I'm very thankful. It complemented my skills very well and provided me a challenge. As for the competition, like I said, he did choose the competition for me to join, and it was a good challenge, and I'm happy I got through. So for the competition, it was just a video submission. It's international, and yeah, if you get through your category, you're able to perform.
Mm-hmm. When was it exactly, and what was the name of the competition and results?
So I think it started late fall. The name of the competition is American Protégé Competition. And yeah, so this video submissions were late fall, and I was performing in January and late December.
And what was the result?
The result was, I guess second place, but that's still, I was still able to perform.
That is nothing to be ashamed of by any stretch of imaginations. Congratulations. Again, not too many 15-year-olds have been at Carnegie Hall, although there have been a few. So,
well, there was a lot of talented people there, though, and they were, again, on the younger side of things. So I was really very impressed to meet them all.
Mm-hmm. How many people were there, do you think?
They had various amount of concerts, but the concert I was in had, I think, 35 people in there, and their ages ranged very much. I could say, like, the youngest is probably, like, around 8 to 10, and the oldest is, like, a senior in high school.
All right. We're speaking again with Eddie Ojard of Two Harbors, recently performed at Carnegie Hall in New York. You're seriously into the classical repertoire, of course, but you also have your own compositions of maybe a somewhat different genre, such as the pieces you've composed about Lake Superior and his tugboats in Minnesota. How would you describe your music?
My music is very, I don't know if it follows a certain genre. Mm-hmm. I would say it is very difficult to describe because I don't follow too much classical principles. I would say I follow more of the modern era kind of music because my form and the way I write is very much like pop music nowadays. But I do try to stick with some forms of the classical music genre.
Mm-hmm. Well, it isn't quite hip-hop, at least not yet. I don't know. You may, knowing you, you'd probably do a little of everything. And the best way to understand it is to listen to it. Your upcoming album is Minnesota Volume 2. You have a piece called Indian Paintbrush. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so the Indian Paintbrush is one of my favorite pieces I have on this album so far. It was from a children's book I read when I was little. And, like, my whole backyard is full of Indian paintbrushes in the fall and summer. So I thought I could write a piece about that and what I think about when I see the Indian paintbrush. So,
mm-hmm. Do you want to describe the plant?
The Indian paintbrush is like, if you look at a paintbrush, right? And it's like with the tip facing up and the top of it is like a little bit red. And then it's like a small but skinny plant. And yeah.
All right, here is the audio version, let's put it that way, of the Indian Paintbrush by Eddie Ojard.
Thank you.
And that was Indian Paintbrush by Eddie Ojard from his upcoming fifth album, Minnesota Volume 2. Eddie recently performed at Carnegie Hall. So what about local engagements? Are you still hitting the local scene?
You know, I've been slowing down on local performances. With college coming up, I kind of need to expand into more broader competitions so I can have my name out there more and kind of build up a resume.
I can't imagine, though, you want to say no to our friends like at Woosel's and places like that.
No, I wouldn't do that. Yeah, I would still perform there.
All right. Well, keep us updated. You don't have to be on the show for us to announce when you have something coming up. Where can we learn more about your music and buy these albums?
Well, there are some of my older albums in Two Harbors and a few in Duluth. Like, I think there's still some in Art Doc. In Two Harbors, there's still some at the Greenhouse and some by the Depot.
And is there a website or a Facebook page we could go to?
I do have a Facebook page. It's just Edward H. Ojard. And if it doesn't pop up, just put Two Harbors. I don't go on Facebook terribly a lot, but when I do have something like big, like say my album came out, I will post on there for sure.
Well, I'm glad you're not on Facebook a lot. That's probably why you ended up at Carnegie Hall. You had time to practice.
Oh, yeah, lots of practicing.
Right. Let's hear one more of yours to take us out.
I'd say Lake Superior. I think that would be the best piece.
Well, we've been speaking with Eddie Ojard of Two Harbors. He recently had his Carnegie Hall debut at age 15, and his fifth album, Minnesota Volume 2, is coming out shortly. Thank you for joining us, Eddie.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Danielle Kading of WPR News. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, the $700 million natural gas plant proposed for Superior is still not off the ground, and now the mayor of Superior is asking state regulators to rethink their approval.
Yeah, he wants to have them revisit the approval of this roughly $700 million natural gas plant that's planned to be built in the city. Superior Mayor Jim Payne filed a letter this month with the Public Service Commission in Wisconsin asking them to conduct a new review of the Nemadji Trail Energy Center. And just to, you know, recap, several utilities want to build this 625 megawatt plant as part of their plans to shift away from coal and invest in renewable energy. And that includes La Crosse-based Dairyland Power Cooperative, Minnesota Power in Duluth, and North Dakota-based Basin Electric Power Cooperative. And essentially, what the mayor is arguing here is that there's been a lot of changes since this project was approved in January of 2020. And he thinks that warrants further review. And some of the things that he'd like them to take a look at include changes to the plant's design, its ownership, and its effects on tribal lands. And he's also concerned about where local approval of this project might play in, because one point that he noted is that state law preempts enforcement of local regulations for any approved projects. And this would require some changes to the city's zoning code and vacation of streets in order for the plant to move forward. And Mayor Payne said the city is unlikely to approve those changes. And so he wants the Public Service Commission to take another look at this. He says all of those things should be reviewed before this project moves forward.
All right. Well, moving statewide in Wisconsin, Democratic Governor Tony Evers says Republican legislators are making it difficult for him to fill important state positions.
That's right, Robin. And in particular, he says it's giving the state a hard time finding a new secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And he says that's due to the firing of his appointees to boards and commissions by the Republican-controlled Senate. And if you recall, back in October, GOP lawmakers voted to fire 8 appointees to state boards and commissions, and that included 4 members of the Natural Resources Board. And just days after that vote, former DNR Secretary Adam Payne told Evers in a letter that he was resigning as head of the agency for personal reasons. And since then, Evers has expressed the difficulty of finding someone because potential candidates have told him that it's a problem for them. They're worried about the potential that they might be fired by the Senate. But Republican senators like Mary Felskowski, who is a northern Wisconsin lawmaker from Tomahawk, she said that, you know, there's no reason for the Senate to serve as a rubber stamp for the governor, that this is their role as lawmakers, that they're here to provide checks and balances, and that finding a new secretary when you have a divided government where we have the Republican-controlled legislature along with a Democratic governor, that it forces both sides to, you know, meet in the middle or find common ground.
All right. And if you're headed out to the Apostle Islands, you may or may not find things in tip-top condition.
Yeah, that's right, Robin. You know, the national parks in Wisconsin and across the country have struggled with a backlog of maintenance projects that have been put off. It's called deferred maintenance. And recent federal reports have revealed that the National Park Service marked up costs and relied on inaccurate data for the agency's estimates of what it might cost to address those projects. In recent years, the Park Service has seen the cost of its maintenance backlog grow from roughly $13 billion in fiscal year 2019 to $22 billion in fiscal year 2022. And this increase occurred at a time when Congress passed the Great American Outdoors Act. And that law set up a fund that devotes billions of dollars to managing buildings, roads, and visitor assets through 2025. But this final report from the Inspector General's office within the U.S. Department of Interior found that the Park Service was both underestimating and overestimating costs of its deferred maintenance projects, and also that they were not addressing work orders related to safety at these parks in a timely fashion. And Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany said that he's been disappointed with the lack of progress on addressing the backlog, including in Wisconsin, citing that, you know, the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore has received some funding through this new law, but that the vast majority of its backlog remains unaddressed. And basically, these reports from the Inspector General's office and also from the Government Accountability Office have found that the Park Service was marking up project costs by 35% across the board, and also that they were facing challenges with inflation and supply chain constraints. And that was one reason that the costs of these projects are going up. So now that these findings have been released, the people who produce these reports say that the agency has been improving its estimates of deferred maintenance and taking steps to put in place policies that would result in more accurate cost estimates for these projects.
Well, Rick, on the Minnesota side, tragedy dominated the news after 2 people were killed at a motel in Cloquet by an alleged gunman who also fatally shot himself.
Yes, hundreds of community members held a candlelight vigil Wednesday night in Cloquet to mourn the death of 22-year-old Shelby Treadle, who was fatally shot Monday during a double homicide while working her shift at the Super 8 Hotel. Treadle was shot alongside 35-year-old Patrick Jeffrey Roars of Deer River, Minnesota, who was staying at the hotel. Police identified 32-year-old Nicholas Elliott Lennius of Ramsey, Minnesota, as the suspect. Lennius was found dead on hotel grounds from what appeared to be a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Community members were united in shock and disbelief about the random act of violence that descended on their small town. Police were called Monday night by a hotel employee who found Treadle and said she looked like she was attacked. Treadle was then transported to St. Luke's in Duluth, where she was later pronounced dead. Police believe that Treadle was Lennius's first victim, who then went outside and shot Roars multiple times while he was inside a vehicle. Lennius then walked a short distance and fatally shot himself. Based on surveillance footage, police believe the entire incident lasted about 10 minutes. They have still yet to determine a motive or a connection between the alleged perpetrator and the victims. On Wednesday night, friends, family, and community members braved the cold, snowy weather to honor the life of Treadle at the hotel where she had worked her entire adult life. Attendees were welcomed with a candle, which they lit for the duration of the remembrance. Mourners held back tears as they paid their respects to a makeshift memorial of candles and flowers in front of the doors. Friends and family members remember Shelby Treadle as a deeply caring person who was unapologetically herself. Her father, Tim Treadle, said she was a light for so many people. She was always one you could count on to talk to when you were down or when you needed help for something.
Again, a tragedy. Well, on the political front, a lawmaker from Duluth who's been part of the DFL leadership team announced she won't be running again.
Yes, District 8A Representative Liz Olson will not seek a fifth term and will instead step down from the Minnesota legislature after 8 years of service. She plans to step down at the end of this year. Olson said, I've served in a minority, I've served in a divided government, and now as part of a political majority. This past session, we got so much done that I had been working on before I even was in the legislature. Some of these issues were part of my motivation to run, and to see so much happen last session, it feels good to be able to leave on a high note. Now, Olson quickly rose as a leader in the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, serving as House Whip, Deputy Majority Leader, Speaker Pro Tempore, and most recently as chair of the powerful Ways and Means Committee. But she recalls a much more modest start as a freshman representative learning the ropes as part of the DFL House minority. Olson said the experience taught her a valuable lesson. That ability to work with people of all political stripes has earned her a sterling reputation, according to Representative Dave Baker, who is a Republican out of Wilmer, Minnesota. He worked closely with Olson to pass legislation that called on opioid manufacturers and distributors to pay licensing fees in a fund that continues to be used to support treatment programs, educate people about the dangers of opioid addiction, and provide other resources to combat the ongoing crisis. Baker, who himself lost his son to opioids, said compromise was essential at the time to get the bill passed by both a Republican-led Senate and DFL-controlled House. Even though they don't always see eye to eye, Baker said he knew he could trust Olson not to twist his words or over-politicize their differences. Olson views the opioid legislation she helped pass with Baker's help as one of her proudest achievements. She said she will leave the legislature knowing she's done her best and achieved results, including the recent passage of a statewide earned sick and safe leave law. Olson said her daughter Florence was 1.5 months old when she first ran for office, and she will enjoy spending time with her family.
All right. We've been joined by Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Danielle Kading, Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. This is, of course, the Martin Luther King holiday weekend, and there are many activities in the Twin Ports. Information can be found at the Duluth NAACP branch website. That's DuluthNAACP.org/MLK. Once again, DuluthNAACP.org/MLK. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone. Happy